damage to these inhibitory factors, musical or artistic powers can potentially be developed, nurtured, and exploited to produce a work of real artistic value, at least as long as frontal lobe function, with its executive and planning powers, is intact. This then may provide a brief, brilliant interlude as the frontotemporal degeneration advances. The degenerative process, unfortunately, does not come to a halt, and sooner or later, all is lost. But for a brief time, for some, there can at least be music or art, with some of the fulfillment, the pleasure and joy it can so uniquely provide. Chapter 28. A Hypermusical Species, Williams Syndrome. In 1995, I visited a special summer camp in Lenox, Massachusetts, to spend a few days with a unique group of people, all of whom had a congenital disorder called Williams Syndrome, which results in a strange mixture of intellectual strengths and deficits. Most have an IQ of less than 60. They all seemed extraordinarily sociable and inquisitive, and though I had met none of these campers before, they instantly greeted me in the most friendly and familiar way. I could have been an old friend, or an uncle, rather than a stranger. They were effusive and chatty, asking about my journey there, whether I had family, what colors and music I liked best. None of them was reticent. Even the younger ones, at an age when most children are shy or wary of strangers, felt free to come up, take me by the hand, look deep into my eyes, and converse with me with an adeptness that belied their years. Most were in their teens or twenties, though there were a few younger children as well as a woman of 46. But age and sex made relatively little difference in their appearance. All of them had wide mouths and upturned noses, small chins, and round, curious, starry eyes. Despite their individuality, they seemed like members of a single tribe, marked by an extraordinary loquacity, effervescence, fondness for telling stories, reaching out to others, fearlessness of strangers, and, above all, a love of music. Soon after I arrived, the campers trooped to a big tent, pulling me along with them, excited at the thought of a Saturday evening dance. Almost all of them would be performing and dancing. Stephen, a stocky 15-year-old, was practicing on his trombone. The pure, assertive, brassy sounds of this, it was clear, satisfied him deeply. Megan, a romantic and outgoing soul, was strumming her guitar and singing soft ballads. Christian, a tall, gangly youth wearing a beret, had a very good ear and was able to pick out and reproduce on the piano songs he had never heard before. It was not just music that the campers were so sensitive, so attuned to. There seemed to be an extraordinary sensitivity to sounds generally, or at least attention to them. Tiny background sounds the rest of us did not hear or were not conscious of were immediately picked up and often imitated by them. One boy could identify the make of a car by the sound of its engine as it approached. As I walked in the woods with another boy the next day, we chanced on a beehive, and he was enchanted by this and started his own humming, which lasted the rest of the day. The sensitivity to sounds is highly individual and can vary moment by moment. One child at the camp might be enthralled by the noise of a particular vacuum cleaner, while another would be unable to stand it. Anne, the eldest at 46, had undergone many surgeries to treat the physical problems that can come with Williams syndrome. She looked much older than her age, but she also conveyed a sense of wisdom and insight, and often seemed to be regarded by the others as a sort of advisor and honored elder. She favored Bach, and played some of the 48 preludes and fugues for me on the piano. Anne lived quasi-independently with some help. She had her own apartment and her own phone, though with her Williams loquacity, she said, she would often run up huge phone bills. Very important to Anne was her close relationship with her music teacher, who seemed to have a most sensitive ability to help her find musical expression for her feelings, as well as helping with the technical challenges of piano playing, which were exacerbated by Anne's medical problems. Even as toddlers, children with Williams syndrome are extraordinarily responsive to music, as I later saw at a Williams syndrome clinic at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore in the Bronx. Here, people of all ages go for periodic medical evaluation, but also to see one another and to make music with a gifted music therapist, Charlotte Farr, whom they seem to adore. Majestic, a small 3-year-old, was withdrawn and unresponsive to everyone and everything in his environment. He was making odd noises of every sort, but Charlotte began to imitate his noises, immediately catching his attention. The two of them began to exchange a volley of noises, which soon became rhythmic patterns, then musical tones and short, improvised melodies. With this, Majestic was transformed in a remarkable way. He became fully engaged and even grabbed Charlotte's guitar. It was bigger than he was, and plucked its strings one by one for himself. His eyes were constantly fixed on Charlotte's face, drawing encouragement, support, and orientation from her. But when the session was over and Charlotte left, he soon reverted to the unresponsive state he had been in before. Deborah, an engaging 7-year-old, was diagnosed with Williams syndrome before she was a year old. Storytelling and play acting were as important for Debbie as music. She always wanted a dramatic accompaniment of words and actions rather than pure music. She knew by heart all the songs from her synagogue, but when her mother began to demonstrate this, she inadvertently sang a melody from her own childhood. "No," said Debbie, "I want to do the song from my synagogue." And she proceeded to sing it. The songs from the synagogue are, of course, charged with meaning and narrative, the drama of ritual and liturgy. It is not coincidental that some cantors, like Richard Tucker, have become opera singers, going from the drama of the synagogue to that of the stage. Tomer, at 6, was a strong, energetic boy, with a tough, outgoing personality to match. He adored drumming and seemed intoxicated by rhythms. When Charlotte demonstrated various complex rhythms, he got these instantly. Indeed, he could simultaneously drum different rhythms with each hand. He anticipated rhythmic phrases and could improvise easily. At one point, the exuberance of drumming so overcame him that he flung the drumsticks down and started dancing instead. When I asked him about the names of different types of drums, he rapidly reeled off 20 different kinds from around the world. With training, Charlotte thought, he could certainly become a professional drummer when he grew up. Pamela, at 48, was, like Anne at the camp, the eldest, and she was highly, at times heart-breakingly, articulate. She became tearful at one point, speaking of the group home where she lived with other disabled people. "They call me all kinds of hurtful things," she said. They did not understand her, could not comprehend, she said, how she could be so articulate and yet so disabled in other ways. She longed for a friend, for someone else with Williams syndrome with whom she could feel at ease, talk and make music. "But there are not enough of us," she said, "so I'm the only Williams in the place." I had the feeling, as I had had with Anne, that Pamela had acquired a painful wisdom, a larger perspective with age. Pamela's mother mentioned that she liked the Beatles, so I started singing Yellow Submarine, and Pamela joined in, bursting into a loud, joyful rendition and smiling broadly. "She comes alive with music," her mother said. She had a huge repertoire, from Yiddish folk songs to Christmas hymns, and once she had started, there was no stopping her. She sang sensitively, always getting the emotion, and yet, I was surprised by this, she was often off-key, sometimes without any clear tonal center whatever. Charlotte, too, had observed this, and had difficulty accompanying Pamela with her guitar. "People with Williams all love music," she said. "They are all deeply moved by it. but not all of them are geniuses. Not all of them are musically talented. Williams syndrome is very rare, affecting perhaps one child in 10,000, and it was not formally described in the medical literature until 1961, when J.C.P. Williams, a New Zealand cardiologist, published a paper on it. The following year, it was independently described by Alois J. Buren and his colleagues in Europe. In Europe, therefore, people tend to refer to Williams-Buren syndrome, but in the United States it is usually known as Williams syndrome. They each described a syndrome characterized by defects of the heart and great vessels, unusual facial conformations, and retardation. The term retardation suggests an overall or global intellectual defect, one that impairs language ability along with all other cognitive powers. But in 1964, G. von Arnim and P. Engel, who noted the elevated calcium levels that seemed to go along with Williams syndrome, also observed a curiously uneven profile of abilities and disabilities. They spoke of the children's friendly and loquacious personalities and their unusual command of language, the last thing one would expect to find in a retarded child. They noted too, though only in passing, that these children seem to have a strong attachment to music. Individual parents of these children, similarly, were often struck by the unusual constellation of strengths and intellectual disabilities their children displayed, and found it very difficult to find appropriate environments or schooling for them, as they were not retarded in the usual sense. In the early 1980s, a group of such parents in California discovered one another and came together to form the nucleus of what would become the Williams Syndrome Association. At much the same point, Ursula Belugi, a cognitive neuroscientist who had pioneered research on deafness and sign language, became fascinated by Williams syndrome. She had met Crystal, a 14-year-old girl with Williams syndrome, in 1983, and was intrigued and charmed by her, not least by her ready improvisations of songs and lyrics. Belugi arranged to see Crystal every week for a year, and this was the start of an enormous enterprise. Belugi is a linguist, albeit one as much attuned to the emotional powers of speech and all the poetic uses of language as to its formal linguistic character. She was fascinated by the large vocabularies and unusual words that youngsters with Williams syndrome would use, despite their low IQs, words like canine, abort, abrasive, evacuate, and solemn. When asked to name as many animals as she could, one child's first responses were newt, saber-toothed tiger, ibex, antelope. And it was not only a large and unusual vocabulary, but all communicative powers that seemed highly developed in these children, especially in contrast to IQ-matched youngsters with Down syndrome. Those with Williams particularly showed a special feeling for narrative. They would use vivid sound effects and other devices to convey feeling and heighten the impact of what they said. Belugi called these audience hookers, locutions like all of a sudden, lo and behold, and guess what happened next. It became increasingly clear to Belugi that this narrative skill went with their hypersociability, their longing to connect and bond with others. They were minutely aware of personal details. They seemed to study people's faces with extraordinary attention, and they showed great sensitivity in reading others' emotions and moods. They seemed strangely indifferent, though, to the non-human in their environments. Indifferent and inept. In some cases, children with Williams syndrome were unable to tie their shoes, to judge obstacles and steps, to get how things were arranged in the house. This was in striking contrast to autistic children, who might fixate on inanimate objects and seemed indifferent to the emotions of others. In some ways, Williams seemed to be the exact opposite of severe autism. Some children with Williams syndrome were utterly unable to put simple Lego blocks together, toys that IQ-matched children with Down syndrome could easily assemble. and many children with Williams syndrome were unable to draw even a simple geometric shape. Belugi showed me how Crystal, despite her IQ of 49, had given a vivid, quirky description of an elephant. What an elephant is, it is one of the animals. And what an elephant does, it lives in the jungle. It can also live in the zoo. And what it has long grey ears, fan ears, ears that can blow in the wind. It has a long trunk that can pick up grass or pick up hay. If they're in a bad mood, it can be terrible. If the elephant gets mad, it could stomp. It could charge. Sometimes elephants can charge. They have big, long tusks. They can damage a car. It could be dangerous. When they're in a pinch, when they're in a bad mood, it can be terrible. You don't want an elephant as a pet. You want a cat or a dog or a bird. But the drawing of an elephant she had done a few minutes earlier bore no resemblance to an elephant, or indeed to anything at all. None of the features she had painstakingly described had actually made their way into the drawing. Observant and often puzzled parents, while noting the problems and difficulties of their children, also noted their unusual social attention and friendliness, their reaching out to others. Many were struck by how, even as infants, their children listened with great attention to music and began to reproduce melodies accurately by singing or humming, even before they could speak. Some parents observed that their children would be so completely absorbed in music that they were unable to attend to anything else. Other children were extremely sensitive to the emotions expressed in music and might burst into tears at a sad song. Others would play their instruments for hours each day or might learn songs in three or four other languages if they liked the melody and beat. This was very much the case with Gloria Lenhoff, a young woman with Williams syndrome who learnt to sing operatic arias in more than 30 languages. In 1988, Bravo Gloria, a documentary about Gloria's remarkable musical abilities, was aired on public television. Soon after, her parents, Howard and Sylvia Lenhoff, were surprised to get a phone call from someone who had seen the documentary, saying, in effect, "That was a wonderful film. But why did you not mention that Gloria has Williams syndrome?" The viewer, a parent, had identified Gloria right away from the characteristic facial features and behaviors of Williams syndrome. This was the first the Lenhoffs had heard of the syndrome. Their daughter was 33. Since then, Howard and Sylvia Lenhoff have been instrumental in bringing awareness to the condition. In 2006, they collaborated with the writer Terry Sforza on The Strangest Song, a book about Gloria's remarkable life. In this, Howard described Gloria's musical precocity. At the age of one, he said, Gloria could listen to The Owl and the Pussycat and Ba Ba Black Sheep over and over again. Rhythm and rhyme delighted her. In her second year, she became able to respond to rhythm. When Howard and Sylvia played their records, Sforza wrote, Gloria grew excited and focused all at once, pulling herself up in the crib, holding on to the railings and bouncing up and down, keeping time to the beat. Howard and Sylvia encouraged Gloria's passion for rhythm by giving her tambourines, drums, and a xylophone, which she played with to the exclusion of all other toys. By her third year, Gloria could carry and sing a tune. And by her fourth year, Sforza noted, she was ravenous for language, greedily picked up bits of Yiddish, Polish, Italian, whatever she heard, absorbed them like a sponge, and started to sing little songs in other languages. She did not know these languages, but she had learned their prosody, their intonations and stresses, by listening to records, and could reproduce them fluently. Already then, at four, there was something extraordinary about Gloria, prefiguring the opera singer she was to become. In 1992, when Gloria was 38, Howard wrote to me, My daughter Gloria has a rich soprano voice and can play on the full-sized piano accordion almost any song she hears. She has a repertoire of about 2,000 songs, yet, like most individuals with Williams syndrome, she cannot add 5 plus 3. Nor can she get along independently. Early in 1993, I met Gloria and accompanied her on the piano while she sang a few numbers from Turandot, which she performed, as always, with brilliance and an impeccable ear. Gloria, despite her deficits, is a dedicated professional who spends most of her time perfecting and expanding her repertoire. We know she is retarded, her father says, but in comparison to her and others with Williams syndrome, are not most of us retarded when it comes to learning and retaining complex music? Gloria's talents are extraordinary, but not unique. At much the same time as her talents were emerging, another unusual youngster, Tim Bailey, was showing a similar picture of striking musical abilities and fluent speech, along with severe intellectual impairments in many other respects. His musicality and the support of his parents and teachers allowed him, like Gloria, to become a performing musician, in his case, a pianist. And in 1994, Gloria and Tim joined three other musically talented people with Williams syndrome to form the Williams Five. They had their debut in Los Angeles, an event that led to features in the Los Angeles Times and on NPR's All Things Considered. While all this delighted Howard Lenhoff, it left him dissatisfied. He was a biochemist, a scientist, and what had science to say about the musical gifts of his daughter and others like her? There had been no scientific attention to the musical passions and talents of people with Williams syndrome. Ursula Belugi was primarily a linguist, and though she had been struck by the musicality of people with Williams syndrome, she had not made a systematic study of it. Lenhoff pressed her and other researchers to investigate this. Not all people with Williams syndrome are as musically talented as Gloria. Few normal people are. But virtually all share her passion for music and are extraordinarily responsive to music on an emotional level. Lenhoff felt, therefore, that there needed to be a proper arena, a musical arena, where people with Williams could meet and interact. He played a crucial role in setting up, in 1994, the camp in Massachusetts, where people with Williams could socialize and make music together and receive formal training in music. In 1995, Ursula Belugi went to the camp for a week. She returned the next year, accompanied by Daniel Levitin, a neuroscientist and professional musician. Belugi and Levitin were thus able to put together and publish the first survey of rhythm in such a musical community, in which they wrote, "People with Williams syndrome had a good, if implicit, understanding of rhythm and its role in musical grammar and form. It was not only rhythm, but all aspects of musical intelligence that seemed to be highly and often precociously developed in people with Williams syndrome. We heard many stories about infants, 12 months, who could match pitch with a parent playing the piano, or toddlers, 24 months, who could sit down at the piano and play back their older siblings' piano lessons. Such anecdotal accounts demand controlled experimental verification, but the similarities among them, and the sheer number of them, lead us to believe that Williams syndrome individuals do have a much higher degree of musical involvement and musicality than normals." That the whole panoply of musical talents could be so strikingly developed in people who were deficient, sometimes severely so, in general intelligence, showed, like the isolated powers of musical savants, that one could indeed speak of a specific musical intelligence, as Howard Gardner had postulated in his theory of multiple intelligences. The musical talents of people with Williams syndrome differ from those of musical savants, however, for savant talents often seem to emerge full-blown, to have something of a mechanical quality, to require little reinforcement by learning or practice, and to be largely independent of influence by others. In children with Williams syndrome, by contrast, there is always a strong desire to play music with and for others. This was very clear with several young people I observed, including Megan, whom I watched during one of her music lessons. She was clearly much attached to her teacher, listened to him carefully, and worked assiduously on suggestions he made. Such engagement manifests itself in many ways, as Belugi and Levitin found when they visited the music camp. William syndrome individuals had an unusually high degree of engagement with music. Music seemed to be not just a very deep and rich part of their lives, but one that was omnipresent. Most of them spent a great proportion of the day singing to themselves or playing instruments, even while walking to the mess hall. When one camper encountered another camper or group of campers involved in a musical activity, the newcomer would either join in immediately or begin swaying appreciatively to the music. This consuming involvement with music is unusual in normal populations. We have rarely encountered this type of total immersion, even among professional musicians. The three dispositions which are so heightened in people with Williams syndrome, the musical, the narrative, and the social, seem to go together, distinct yet intimately associated elements of the ardent, expressive, and communicative drive that is absolutely central in Williams syndrome. Given so extraordinary a constellation of cognitive talents and deficits, Berugi and others started to explore what their cerebral basis might be. Brain imaging, along with, more rarely, autopsy reports, revealed remarkable divergences from the normal. The brains of people with Williams syndrome were, on average, 20% smaller than normal brains, and their shape was quite unusual, for the decrease in size and weight seemed to be exclusively at the back of the brain, in the occipital and parietal lobes, whereas the temporal lobes were of normal and sometimes supernormal size. This corresponded with what had been so clear in the uneven cognitive abilities of those with Williams. The devastating impairments of visuospatial sense could be attributed to the underdevelopment of parietal and occipital areas, while the strong auditory, verbal, and musical abilities could, in general terms, be attributed to the large size and rich neuronal networks of the temporal lobes. The primary auditory cortex was larger in people with Williams syndrome, and there seemed to be significant changes in the planum temporale, a structure known to be crucial for the perception of both speech and music, as well as for absolute pitch. Finally, Levitin, Berugi, and others turned to investigating the functional correlates of musicality in Williams syndrome. Were the musicality and the emotional response to music in those with Williams syndrome, they wondered, subserved by the same sort of neurofunctional architecture as that in normal subjects or in professional musicians? They played a variety of music, from Bach cantatas to Strauss waltzes, to all three groups, and it was evident from brain imaging that people with Williams syndrome processed the music very differently from the others. They employed a much wider set of neural structures to perceive and respond to music, including regions of the cerebellum, brainstem, and amygdala, which are scarcely activated at all in normal subjects. This very extensive brain activation, particularly of the amygdala, seemed to go with their almost helpless attraction to music, and their sometimes overwhelming emotional reactions to it. All of these studies, Berugi feels, suggest that the brains of Williams syndrome individuals are organized differently from normals at both a macro and a micro level. The very distinctive mental and emotional characteristics of people with Williams syndrome are reflected very precisely and beautifully in the peculiarities of their brains. Though this study of the neural basis of Williams syndrome is far from complete, it has nonetheless already made possible the most extensive correlation ever made between a multitude of mental and behavioral characteristics and their cerebral basis. In people with Williams syndrome, it is now known, there is a microdeletion of 15 to 25 genes on one chromosome. The deletion of this tiny gene cluster, less than a thousandth part of the 25,000 or so genes in the human genome, is responsible for all of the features of Williams syndrome, the abnormalities of the heart and blood vessels, which have insufficient elastin, the unusual facial and bony features, and, not least, the unusual development of the brain, so well developed in some ways, so underdeveloped in others, which underlies the unique cognitive and personality profile of those with Williams. Most recent research has suggested differentiation within this gene cluster, but the most tantalizing part of the puzzle still eludes us. We think we know which genes are responsible for some of the cognitive deficits of Williams syndrome, such as the lack of visuospatial sense, but we do not know how such a deletion of genes can give rise to the special gifts of people with Williams syndrome. It is not even certain that these have a direct genetic basis. It is possible, for example, that some of these skills are simply spared by the vicissitudes of brain development in Williams syndrome, or that they may arise as a sort of compensation for the relative lack of other functions. Freud once wrote, "Anatomy is destiny." Now we tend to think that destiny is written in our genes. Certainly, Williams syndrome affords an extraordinarily rich and precise view of how a particular genetic endowment can shape the anatomy of a brain, and how this, in turn, will shape particular cognitive strengths and weaknesses, personality traits, and perhaps even creativity. And yet, beneath the superficial similarities among people with Williams syndrome, there is an individuality that, as with us all, is largely determined by experience. In 1994, I visited Heidi Comfort, a young girl with Williams syndrome, at her home in Southern California. A very self-possessed 8-year-old, she immediately detected my own diffidence and said, encouragingly, "Don't be shy, Mr. Sachs." As soon as I arrived, she offered me some just-baked muffins. At one point, I covered the tray of muffins and asked her to tell me how many there were. She guessed 3. I uncovered the tray and invited her to count them. She pointed to them one by one and came up with a total of 8. There were, in fact, 13. She showed me her room and her favorite things, as any 8-year-old might. A few months later, we met again in Ursula Belugi's lab, then went out for a walk. We watched the kites and hang gliders sailing above the La Jolla Cliffs. In town, we gazed into the windows of a pastry shop, and then stopped for lunch at a sandwich shop, where Heidi instantly befriended the half-dozen workers behind the counter, learning all their names. At one point, she leaned so far over the counter, fascinated by the sandwich-making, that she nearly fell into the tuna fish. Her mother, Carol Zeitzer Comfort, told me that she had once warned her child not to speak to strangers, and Heidi had replied, "There are no strangers. There are only friends." Heidi could be eloquent and funny, and she loved to spend hours listening to music and playing the piano. She was already composing little songs at 8. She had all the energy, impulsiveness, verbosity, and charm of Williams syndrome, and many of the problems. She could not form a simple geometric shape with some wooden blocks, as most children can do by nursery school. She had great difficulty placing a set of nesting cups into the right order. We went to the aquarium, where we saw a giant octopus, and I asked her how much it might weigh. 3,200 pounds, she replied. Later that day, she estimated that the creature had been as big as a building. Her cognitive impairments might be, I thought, quite disabling, both in school and in the world, and I could not avoid the feeling that there might be a sort of formulaic quality to her sociability, an automaticity. It was difficult for me to see her at 8 as an individual, separate from the superficial qualities of her Williams syndrome. But 10 years later, I received a letter from her mother. "Heidi has just had her 18th birthday," Carol wrote. "I'm attaching a picture of her with her boyfriend at their homecoming dance. She is in her senior year at high school and has definitely come into her own as a young woman. Dr. Sachs, you were right when you predicted that the who would emerge through the what of Williams syndrome." Heidi was 19 now, and despite several brain surgeries to treat increased pressure, such procedures are occasionally necessary in some people with Williams syndrome, she was planning to leave home soon, to attend a residential college program where she would take academic courses, receive job coaching, and prepare to live independently. She planned to learn how to be a professional baker. She loved watching people decorate cakes and make desserts. But a few months ago, I received another letter from her mother, telling me that Heidi had started a new job, and it sounds as though she may have found another calling. She is working at a convalescent home and just loves it. The patients say that Heidi's bright smile cheers them up and helps them feel better. Heidi enjoys the socializing so much that she has asked if she can visit the patients on the weekends. She plays bingo, paints their fingernails, gets them coffee, and of course, talks and listens. This job is a perfect fit for her. Chapter 29. Music and Identity. Dementia and Music Therapy. Of the 500 or so neurological patients at my hospital, about half have dementia of various sorts, from multiple strokes, from cerebral hypoxia, from toxic or metabolic abnormalities, from brain injuries or infections, from frontotemporal degeneration, or, most commonly, from Alzheimer's disease. Some years ago, Donna Cohen, a colleague of mine, after studying our large population of patients with Alzheimer's, co-authored a book called The Loss of Self. For various reasons, I deplored the title, though it is a very good book as a resource for families and caregivers, and set myself to contradicting it, lecturing here and there on Alzheimer's disease and the preservation of self. And yet I am not sure that we were in real disagreement. Certainly, someone with Alzheimer's loses many of his powers or faculties as the disease advances, though this process may take many years. The loss of certain forms of memory is often an early indicator of Alzheimer's, and this may progress to a profound amnesia. Later, there may be impairment of language and, with the involvement of the frontal lobes, loss of subtler and deeper powers, like judgment, foresight, and the ability to plan. Eventually, a person with Alzheimer's may lose some fundamental aspects of self-awareness, in particular, the awareness of their own incapacities. But does the loss of one's self-awareness, or some aspects of mind, constitute loss of self? Shakespeare's Jaques in As You Like It, considering the seven ages of man, sees the final one as sans everything. Yet, though one may be profoundly reduced and impaired, one is never sans everything, never a tabula rasa. Someone with Alzheimer's may undergo a regression to a second childhood, but aspects of one's essential character, of personality and personhood, of self, survive, along with certain almost indestructible forms of memory, even in very advanced dementia. It is as if identity has such a robust, widespread neural basis, as if personal style is so deeply ingrained in the nervous system that it is never wholly lost, at least while there is still any mental life present at all. This, indeed, is what one might expect if perceptions and actions, feelings and thoughts have moulded the structure of one's brain from the start. This is poignantly clear in such memoirs as John Bailey's Elegy for Iris. In particular, the response to music is preserved, even when dementia is very advanced. But the therapeutic role of music in dementia is quite different from what it is in patients with motor or speech disorders. Music that helps patients with Parkinsonism, for example, must have a firm, rhythmic character, but it need not be familiar or evocative. With aphasics, it is crucial to have songs with lyrics or intoned phrases and interaction with a therapist. The aim of music therapy in people with dementia is far broader than this. It seeks to address the emotions, cognitive powers, thoughts, and memories, the surviving self of the patient, to stimulate these and bring them to the fore. It aims to enrich and enlarge existence, to give freedom, stability, organization, and focus. This might seem a very tall order, nearly impossible, one would think, seeing patients with advanced dementia who may sit in a seemingly mindless, vacant torpor or scream agitatedly in incommunicable distress. But music therapy with such patients is possible because musical perception, musical sensibility, musical emotion, and musical memory can survive long after other forms of memory have disappeared. Music of the right kind can serve to orient and anchor a patient when almost nothing else can. I see this continually with my patients, and I hear of it constantly in the letters I receive. One man wrote to me about his wife. Although my wife has Alzheimer's, diagnosed at least 7 years ago, the essential person miraculously remains. She plays piano several hours daily, very well. Her present ambition is to memorize the Schumann A minor piano concerto. And yet, this is a woman who is, in most other spheres, grossly forgetful and disabled. Nietzsche, too, continued to improvise at the piano long after he had been rendered mute, demented, and partially paralyzed by neurosyphilis. The extraordinary neural robustness of music is also brought out in the following letter I was sent about a well-known pianist. He is 88 now and has lost language, but he plays every day. When we read through Mozart, he points back and ahead well in advance of the repeats. 2 years ago, we recorded the complete four-hand repertoire of Mozart that he had recorded in the 1950s. While his language has begun to fail him, I love his recent playing and conception even more than the earlier recording. Especially moving here is not merely the preservation, but the apparent heightening of musical powers and sensitivity as other powers wane. My correspondent concluded, "The extremes of musical accomplishment and illness are so plainly evident in his case. A visit becomes miraculous as he transcends the disease with music." Mary Ellen Geist, a writer, contacted me a few months ago about her father, Woody, who began to show signs of Alzheimer's 13 years ago, at the age of 67. "Now," she said, "the plaque has apparently invaded a large amount of his brain, and he can't remember much of anything about his life. However, he remembers the baritone part to almost every song he has ever sung. He has performed with a 12-man a cappella singing group for almost 40 years. Music is one of the only things that keep him grounded in this world. He has no idea what he did for a living, where he is living now, or what he did 10 minutes ago. Almost every memory is gone, except for the music. In fact, he opened for the Radio City Music Hall Rockettes in Detroit this past November. The evening he performed, he had no idea how to tie a tie. He got lost on the way to the stage, but the performance? Perfect. He performed beautifully and remembered all the parts and words." A few weeks later, I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Geist, his daughter, and his wife, Rosemary. Mr. Geist was, in fact, carrying a newspaper, a neatly furled New York Times, though he did not know it was the New York Times, nor, apparently, what a newspaper was. He was well-groomed and neatly dressed, though this, his daughter later told me, had needed supervision, for left alone he might put on his pants backwards, not recognize his shoes, shave with toothpaste, and so on. When I asked Mr. Geist how he was, he replied, pleasantly, "I think I am in good health." This reminded me of how Ralph Waldo Emerson, after he became severely demented, would answer such questions by saying, "Quite well. I have lost my mental faculties, but am perfectly well." Emerson developed a dementia, probably Alzheimer's, in his early 60s, and this gradually grew more severe over the years, though he retained his sense of humor and ironical insight almost to the end. The trajectory of Emerson's illness is portrayed with great sensitivity by David Schenck in his remarkable book, The Forgetting, Alzheimer's, Portrait of an Epidemic. Indeed, there was an Emersonian sweetness and reasonableness and serenity in Woody, as he immediately introduced himself. He was profoundly demented, without doubt, but he had preserved his character, his courtesy, his thoughtfulness. Despite the manifest ravages of Alzheimer's, his loss of event memory and of general knowledge, his disorientation, his cognitive defects, the behaviors of civility, it seemed, were ingrained, perhaps at a much deeper and older level. I wondered whether these were merely habits, mimicries, residues of once meaningful behavior, now empty of feeling and meaning. But Mary Ellen had never thought this. She felt her father's civility and courtesy, his sensitive and thoughtful behavior, to be almost telepathic. "The way he reads my mother's face to find out how she is doing," she wrote, the way he reads her mood, the way he reads people in social situations and acts accordingly, is beyond mimicking. Woody seemed to be tiring of questions to which he could not supply an answer, such as, "Can you read this?" or, "Where were you born?" So I asked him to sing. Mary Ellen had told me how, since she could first remember, the whole family, Woody, Rosemary, and the three daughters, had sung together, and how singing had always been a central part of family life. Woody had been whistling when he came in, whistling Somewhere Over the Rainbow, so I asked him to sing it. Rosemary and Mary Ellen joined in, and the three of them sang beautifully, each harmonizing in different ways. When Woody sang, he showed all the expressions, emotions, and postures appropriate to the song, and to singing in a group, turning to the others, awaiting their cues, and so on. This was so with all the songs they sang, whether they were exuberant, jazzy, lyrical and romantic, funny or sad. Mary Ellen had brought along a CD Woody had recorded years before with his a cappella group, the Grunions, and when we played this, Woody sang along beautifully. His musicality, at least his performing musicality, like his civility and equanimity, was completely intact. But again I wondered if it could be just a mimesis, just a performance, representing feelings and meanings he no longer had. Certainly Woody looked more present when singing than at any other time. I asked Rosemary whether she felt that he, the man she had known and loved for 55 years, was totally present in his singing. She said, "I think he probably is." Rosemary looked tired, exhausted from her almost non-stop caring for her husband and the inch-by-inch way in which she was being widowed, as he lost more and more of what used to constitute his self. But she was least sad, least widowed, when they all sang together. He seemed so present at such times that his absence a few minutes later, his forgetting that he had sung or could sing, would always come as a shock. Given her father's powerful musical memory, Mary Ellen asked, "Why can't we use this as an opening? Embed shopping lists, information about himself, in his songs?" I said I feared this would not work. Mary Ellen had, in fact, found this out already for herself. "Why couldn't we sing him his life story?" she had written in her journal in 2005, or the directions from one room to the next. "I've tried. It doesn't work." I, too, had had this thought in relation to Greg, an intelligent, very musical, very amnesic patient I had seen years before. Writing about him in the New York Review of Books in 1992, I observed, "It is easy to show that simple information can be embedded in songs. Thus we can give Greg the date every day, in the form of a jingle, and he can readily isolate this and say it when asked. Give it, that is, without the jingle. But what does it mean to say, 'This is December the 19th, 1991, when one is sunk in the profoundest amnesia, when one has lost one's sense of time and history, when one is existing from moment to moment in a sequenceless limbo? Knowing the date means nothing in these circumstances. Could one, however, through the evocativeness and power of music, perhaps using songs with specially written lyrics, songs which relate something valuable about himself or the current world, accomplish something more lasting, deeper? Give Greg not only facts, but a sense of time and history, of the relatedness and not merely the existence of events, an entire, if synthetic, framework for thinking. This is something which Connie Tomeno and I are trying to do now. We hope to have an answer in a year." But by 1995, when The Last Hippie was republished in book form, in An Anthropologist on Mars, we had got our answer, and it was resoundingly negative. There was not, and perhaps could never be, any carryover from performance and procedural memory to explicit memory or usable knowledge. While, at least in someone as amnesic as Greg or Woody, singing cannot be used as a sort of back door to explicit memory, still, the act of singing is important in itself. Finding, remembering anew that he can sing, is profoundly reassuring to Woody, as the exercise of any skill or competence must be, and it can stimulate his feelings, his imagination, his sense of humour and creativity, and his sense of identity, as nothing else can. It can enliven him, calm him, focus and engage him. It can give him back himself. And not least, it can charm others, arouse their amazement and admiration, reactions more and more necessary to someone who, in his lucid moments, is painfully aware of his tragic disease, and sometimes says that he feels broken inside. The mood engendered by singing can last a while, sometimes even outlasting the memory that he has sung, which may be lost within a couple of minutes. I could not help thinking of my patient, Dr. P., the man who mistook his wife for a hat, and how vital singing was for him, and how my prescription for him was a life that consisted entirely of music and singing. Perhaps Woody, though he could not have put it into words, knows that this is the case for him, for in the last year or so he has taken to whistling. He whistled somewhere over the rainbow softly to himself for the entire afternoon we spent together. Whenever he is not actively singing or otherwise engaged, Mary Ellen and Rosemary told me, he now whistles all the while. Not only through his waking hours, he whistles and sometimes sings in his sleep. So, at least in this sense, Woody is companioned by music, calls on it around the clock. There is, of course, a world of difference between such patients who, with the help of family, friends, and therapists, are still living a semi-independent life in the outside world, and the patients with very advanced dementias, who constitute much of the population of a chronic disease hospital or nursing home. Nevertheless, music may be as important to people with advanced dementia as it is to those in the earlier stages. Bessie T., a lady in her 80s, is a former blues singer who used to work at the famous Apollo Club in Harlem. She now lives in a nursing home, though she often thinks she still works in a store. I work in men's clothing, the better line. Her Alzheimer's has left her with an amnesia so severe that she can hold nothing in mind for more than a minute. But learning that there was to be a talent show at the hospital, she, with her music therapist, practiced her songs assiduously, getting better all the time, though retaining no explicit memory of her practice sessions. When the day came and she was escorted to the microphone and asked if she would sing for the audience, she said, "Sure, honey, but why didn't you ask me before?" She then went on to sing, beautifully, with great feeling, though a few moments later, she had no memory of having performed. Sometimes music therapy is communal, sometimes individual. It is astonishing to see mute, isolated, confused individuals warm to music, recognize it as familiar, and start to sing, start to bond with a therapist. It is even more astonishing to see a dozen deeply demented people, all in worlds or non-worlds of their own, seemingly incapable of any coherent reactions, let alone interactions, and how they respond to the presence of a music therapist who begins to play music in front of them. There is a sudden attention. A dozen pairs of distracted eyes fasten on the player. Torpid patients become alert and aware. Agitated ones grow calmer. That it may be possible to gain the attention of such patients and hold it for minutes at a time is itself remarkable. Beyond this, there is often a specific engagement with what is being played. It is usual in such groups to play old songs that everyone of a similar age and background will have known. Familiar music acts as a sort of Proustian mnemonic, eliciting emotions and associations that had been long forgotten, giving the patient access once again to moods and memories, thoughts and worlds that had seemingly been completely lost. Faces assume expression as the old music is recognized and its emotional power felt. One or two people, perhaps, start to sing along, others join them, and soon the entire group, many of them virtually speechless before, is singing together as much as they are able. Together is a crucial term, for a sense of community takes hold, and these patients, who seemed incorrigibly isolated by their disease and dementia, are able, at least for a while, to recognize and bond with others. I receive many letters about such effects from music therapists and others who play or sing music to the demented. One Australian music therapist, Greta Sculthorpe, after working in nursing homes and hospitals for 10 years, expressed this eloquently. At first I thought I was providing entertainment, but now I know that what I do is act as a can-opener for people's memories. I can't predict what will be the trigger for each person, but there is usually something for everyone, and I have a part of my brain that watches in stunned amazement what is happening. One of the loveliest outcomes of my work is that nursing staff can suddenly see their charges in a whole new light, as people who have had a past, and not only a past, but a past with joy and delight in it. There are listeners who come and stand beside or in front of me, touching me for the whole time. There are always people who cry. There are people who dance and people who join in, for operetta or for Sinatra songs, and Lieder in German. There are disturbed people who become calm, and silent people who give voice, frozen people who beat time. There are people who don't know where they are, but who recognize me immediately as the singing lady. With a movement disorder like Parkinson's disease, there is no significant carryover effect with the power of music. The patient can regain a fluent motor flow with music, but once the music stops, so too does the flow. There can, however, be longer-term effects of music for people with dementia, improvements of mood, behavior, even cognitive function, which can persist for hours or days after they have been set off by music. I see this in the clinic almost daily, and constantly receive descriptions of such effects from others. Jan Colton, who coordinates caregiving to the elderly, wrote to me with this story. One of our caregivers went home and made the simple intervention of turning on the classical music channel in front of the couch where her mother-in-law had mostly sat watching TV shows for the preceding 3 years. The mother-in-law, diagnosed with dementia, had kept the house awake at night when the caregivers turned off the TV in order to get some sleep. Daytimes, she would not get off the couch for toileting or family meals. After the channel change, she had a profound behavioral change. She asked to come to breakfast the next morning and did not want to watch her usual TV fare the next day, and asked for her long-neglected embroidery the next afternoon. Over the next 6 weeks, in addition to communicating with her family and taking more interest in her surroundings, she mostly listened to music, primarily country and western, which she loved. After 6 weeks, she died peacefully. The perception of music and the emotions it can stir is not solely dependent on memory, and music does not have to be familiar to exert its emotional power. I have seen deeply demented patients weep or shiver as they listen to music they have never heard before, and I think that they can experience the entire range of feelings the rest of us can, and that dementia, at least at these times, is no bar to emotional depth. Once one has seen such responses, one knows that there is still a self to be called upon, even if music, and only music, can do the calling. There are undoubtedly particular areas of the cortex subserving musical intelligence and sensibility, and there can be forms of amusia with damage to these. But the emotional response to music, it would seem, is widespread, and probably not only cortical but subcortical, so that even in a diffuse cortical disease like Alzheimer's, music can still be perceived, enjoyed, and responded to. One does not need to have any formal knowledge of music, nor indeed to be particularly musical to enjoy music and to respond to it at the deepest levels. Music is part of being human, and there is no human culture in which it is not highly developed and esteemed. Its very ubiquity may cause it to be trivialized in daily life. We switch on a radio, switch it off, hum a tune, tap our feet, find the words of an old song going through our minds, and think nothing of it. But to those who are lost in dementia, the situation is different. Music is no luxury to them, but a necessity, and can have a power beyond anything else to restore them to themselves and to others, at least for a while. This is John Lee. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain by Oliver Sacks, published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2007 by Oliver Sacks, M.D. Production copyright 2007, Books on Tape.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.